found Mr. Black. "I'm not sure what the protocol is for greeting a detective. I've received training from Mr. Snow on how to greet businessmen, heads of state, and Instagram stars, but never did he mention what to do in the case of detectives. I must resort to my own ingenuity and my memories of Columbo. I stand, then realize the teacup is still in my hand. I shuffle over to Mr. Snow's mahogany desk, where I'm about to place it down, but there is no coaster. I spot the coasters on the other side of the room, on a shelf filled with sumptuous leather-bound volumes that would be laborious to clean, but also quite satisfying. I take one coaster, return to Mr. Snow's desk, place it down, square it to the desk's corner, and then set my rose-ornamented cup upon it, careful not to spill so much as a drop of the cold tea. There, I say. Then I approach the detective and meet her discerning eye. Detective, I say, just as they do on television. I perform a somewhat curtsy by placing one foot behind the other and nodding my head curtly. The detective glances at Mr. Snow, then back at me. What an awful day for you, the detective says. Her voice is not without warmth, I don't think. Oh, it wasn't all awful, I say. I've just been running through it in my mind. It was actually mostly pleasant until approximately 3 o'clock. The detective looks at Mr. Snow again. Shock, he says. She's in shock. Perhaps Mr. Snow is correct. The next thought I have suddenly seems most urgent to articulate out loud. Mr. Snow, thank you so much for the cup of tea and the lovely shortbread biscuit. Did you bring them, or did someone else? I truly enjoyed both. May I ask, what brand is the shortbread? Mr. Snow clears his throat. Then he says, those are made in our own kitchens, Molly. I would be happy to bring you more another time. But right now, it's important to discuss something else. Right now, Detective Stark has a few questions for you, seeing as how you were first on the scene of Mr. Black's... of his... deathbed, I say, helpfully. Mr. Snow looks down at his well-polished shoes. The detective crosses her arms. I do believe her eyes are drilling into mine in a meaningful way, yet I'm not sure what that meaning is exactly. If Gran were here, I would ask her, but she is not here. She will never be here again. Molly, Mr. Snow says, you're not in trouble in any way, but the detective would like to talk to you as a witness. Perhaps there are details you noticed about the scene or about the day that would be helpful to the investigation. The investigation? I say. Do you presume to know how Mr. Black died? I ask. Detective Stark clears her throat. I presume nothing at this point. How very sensible, I say. So you don't think that Mr. Black was murdered? Detective Stark's eyes open wide. Well, it's more likely he died of a heart attack, she says. There's petechial hemorrhaging around his eyes, consistent with cardiac arrest. Petechial hemorrhaging? Mr. Snow asks. Tiny bruises around the eyes. Happens during a heart attack, but it can also mean other things. At this point, we don't know anything for sure. We'll be doing a thorough investigation to rule out foul play. This puts me in mind of a very funny joke that Gran used to tell. What do you call a poor rendition of Hamlet performed by chickens? Foul play. I smile at the recollection. Molly, says Mr. Snow, do you realize the gravity of this situation? His eyebrows knit together, and then I realize what I've done, how my smile has been misinterpreted. My apologies, sir, I explain. I was thinking of a joke. The detective uncrosses her arms and places both hands squarely on her hips. Again, she stares at me in that way of hers. I'd like to bring you to the station, Molly, she says, to take your witness statement. I'm afraid that won't be possible, I say. I haven't completed my shift, and Mr. Snow counts on me to do my fair share as a maid. Oh, that's quite all right, Molly, Mr. Snow says. This is an exceptional circumstance, and I do insist that you help Detective Stark. We will remunerate you for your full shift, so don't worry about that. It's a relief to hear this. Given the current state of my finances, I simply can't afford to lose wages. That's very good of you, Mr. Snow, I say. Then another thought occurs to me. So I'm not in any trouble? Is that correct? No, says Mr. Snow. Isn't that right, Detective? No, not at all. We just need to know what you saw today. What you noticed, especially at the scene.
You mean in Mr. Black's suite?
Yes. When I found him dead?
Yes. I see. Where shall I take my soiled teacup, Mr. Snow? I'm happy to return it to the kitchen. Never leave a mess to be discovered by a guest.
I'm quoting from Mr. Snow's most recent professional development seminar, but alas, he doesn't acknowledge my witty rejoinder.
Don't worry about the cup. I'll take care of it, he says.
And with that, the detective leads the way, ushering me out of Mr. Snow's office, through the illustrious front lobby of the Regency Grand Hotel, and out the service door. Chapter 4. I am in the police station. It feels odd not to be either at the Regency Grand or at home in Grand's apartment. I have trouble calling it my apartment, but I suppose it's mine now. Mine and mine alone for as long as I can manage to pay the rent. Now here I am in a place I've never been before, a place I certainly never expected to be in today, a small, white, cinder block room with only two chairs, a table, and a camera in the upper left corner, blinking a red light at me. The fluorescent illumination in here is too sharp and blinding. While I have a great appreciation of bright white in decor and clothing, this style choice is definitely not working. White only works when a room is clean, and make no mistake, this room is far from clean. Perhaps it's an occupational hazard. I see dirt where others don't. The stains on the wall where a black briefcase likely grazed it. The coffee rings on the white table in front of me, two round brown O's, the gray thumbprints smeared around the doorknob, the geometric treads left on the floor from an officer's wet boots. Detective Stark left me here just a few moments ago. Our car ride over was pleasant enough. She let me sit in the front of the car, which I appreciated. I'm no criminal, thank you very much, so there's no need to treat me like one. She tried to make small talk during the drive. I'm not good at small talk.
So, how long have you worked at the Regency Grand? She asked.
It's now approximately 4 years, 13 weeks, and 5 days. I may be off by a day, but no more. I could tell you exactly if you have a calendar.
Not necessary.
She shook her head slowly for a few seconds, which I took to mean I'd offered too much information. Mr. Snow taught me KISS, K-I-S-S, which isn't what you think. It stands for Keep It Simple, Stupid. To be clear, he wasn't calling me stupid. He was suggesting that sometimes I overexplain, which I've learned can be annoying to others. When we reached the station, Detective Stark greeted the receptionist, which was rather good of her. I do appreciate when so-called superiors properly greet their employees. No one is too high or too low for common courtesy, Gran would say. Once we were in the station, the detective led me to this small room at the back.
Can I get you anything before we begin our chat? How about a cup of coffee?
Tea? I asked.
I'll see what I can do.
Now she's back with a styrofoam cup in her hand.
Sorry, there's no tea to be had in this cop shop. I brought you some water instead.
A styrofoam cup. I detest styrofoam. The way it squeaks, the way dirt clings to it, the way even the slightest nick with a fingernail leaves a permanent scar. But I know to be polite. I won't make a fuss.
Thank you, I say.
She clears her throat and sits in the chair across from mine. She has a yellow notepad and a Bic pen, the top chewed. I will my mind not to think about the universe of bacteria dwelling on the top of that pen. She puts her pad down on the table, the pen beside it. She leans back and looks at me in that penetrating way of hers.
You're not in any trouble, Molly, she says. I just want you to know that.
I'm well aware, I say. The yellow pad is askew, approximately 47 degrees off from being square with the corner of the table. Before I can stop them, my hands move to rectify this untidiness, shifting the pad so it's parallel with the table. The pen is also askew, but there is no power on earth great enough to make me touch it. Detective Stark watches me, her head cocked to one side. This may be uncharitable, but she looks like a large dog listening for sounds in the forest. Eventually, she speaks.
It seems to me that Mr. Snow might be right about you, that you're in shock. It's common for people in shock to have trouble expressing their emotions. I've seen it before.
Detective Stark does not know me at all. I suppose Mr. Snow didn't tell her much about me either. She thinks my behavior is peculiar, that I'm out of sorts because I found Mr. Black dead in his bed. And while it was shocking, and I am out of sorts, I'm feeling much better now than I was a few hours ago, and I'm most certain that I'm behaving quite normally indeed. What I really want is to go home, to make myself a proper cup of tea, and perhaps text Rodney about the day's events in the hopes that he might console me in some way or offer himself for a date. If that doesn't transpire, not all is lost. I might take a nice bath and read an Agatha Christie novel. Gran has so many of them, all of which I've read more than once. I decide not to share any of these thoughts. Instead, I agree with Detective Stark insofar as I can without complete deception. Detective, I say, you may be right that I am in shock, and I'm sorry if you think I'm not quite myself. It's perfectly understandable, she says, and her lips lift into a smile. At least, I think it's a smile. I can rarely be certain. I'd like to ask you what you saw when you entered the Black Suite this afternoon. Did you see anything out of place or unusual? During each and every shift, I encounter a panoply of things that are out of place or unusual, and not just in the Black Suite. Today, I found a curtain rod ripped from its hinges in a room on the third floor, a contraband hot plate left in plain sight on a bathroom counter on the fourth floor, and six very giggly ladies trying to hide air mattresses under a bed in a room meant for two guests only. I did my due diligence and reported all of these infractions, and more, to Mr. Snow.
Your devotion to the high standards of the Regency Grand knows no bounds, Mr. Snow said, but he did not smile. His lips remained a perfect horizontal line.
Thank you, I replied, feeling quite good about my report.
I consider what it is the detective really wants to know, and what I'm prepared to divulge.
Detective, I say, the Black Suite was in its usual state of disarray when I entered this afternoon. There wasn't much out of the ordinary, except the pills on the bedside table. I offer this up on purpose because it's a detail that even the most nitwitted investigator would have noticed at the scene. What I don't want to discuss are the other things: the robe on the floor, the safe being open, the missing money, the flight itinerary, Giselle's purse being gone the second time I went into the room, and what I saw in that mirror in Mr. Black's bedroom. I've watched enough murder mysteries to know who the prime suspects tend to be. Wives often top the list, and the last thing I want is to cast any doubt on Giselle. She's blameless in all of this, and she's my friend. I'm worried for her.
We're looking into those pills, the detective says.
They're Giselle's, I say, despite myself. I cannot believe her name popped right out of my mouth. Perhaps I really am in shock, because my thoughts and my mouth aren't working in tandem the way they usually do.
How do you know the pills are Giselle's? The detective asks, never looking up from the pad she writes on. The container wasn't labeled.
I know because I handle all of Giselle's toiletries. I line them up when I clean the bathroom. I like to organize them from tallest to smallest, though I'll sometimes ascertain first if a guest prefers a different method of organization.
A different method?
Yes, such as makeup products, medicines, feminine hygiene products. Detective Stark's mouth opens slightly. Or shaving implements, moisturizers, hair tonics. Do you see? She is silent for too long. She's looking at me like I'm the idiot, when clearly she's the one unable to grasp my very simple logic. The truth is that I know the pills are Giselle's because I've seen her pop them into her mouth several times while I've been in her room. I even asked about them once.
These, she said, they calm me down when I freak out. Want one?
I politely declined. Drugs are for pain management only, and I'm acutely aware of what can happen when they're abused.
The detective carries on with her questions. When you arrived in the Black's room, did you go straight to the bedroom?
No, I say. That would be against protocols. First, I announced my arrival, thinking that perhaps someone was in the suite. As it turns out, I was 100% correct on that assumption.
The detective looks at me and says nothing.
I wait. You didn't write that down, I say.
Write what down?
What I just said. She gives me an unreadable look, then picks up her plume de peste and jots down my words,
smacking the pen against the pad when she's done. "So then what?" she asks.
"Well," I say, "when no one answered, I ventured into the sitting room, which was quite untidy. I wanted to clean it up, but first I thought it right to look around the rest of the suite. I walked into the bedroom and found Mr. Black in bed, as though he were resting." Her chewed pen cap wags at me menacingly as she scratches down my words.
"Go on," she prompts.
I explain how I approached Mr. Black's bedside, checked for breath, for a pulse, but found none, how I called down to reception for help. I tell her all of it, up to a point. She writes furiously now, occasionally pausing to look at me, putting that germ factory of a pen in her mouth as she does so. "Tell me something. Do you know Mr. Black very well? Have you ever had conversations with him beyond just about cleaning their suite?"
"No," I reply.
"Mr. Black was always aloof. He drank a lot and did not seem partial to me at all, so I stayed clear of him as much as possible."
"And Giselle Black?" the detective asked.
I thought of Giselle, of all the times we'd conversed, of the intimacies shared, hers and mine. That's how a friendship is built, one small truth at a time. I thought back to the very first time, many months ago, when I met Giselle. I'd cleaned the Black suite many times before, but I'd never actually met Giselle. It was in the morning, probably around 9:30, when I knocked on the door and Giselle let me in. She was wearing a soft pink dressing gown made of satin or silk. Her dark hair cascaded onto her shoulders in perfect waves. She reminded me of the starlets in the old black and white movies that Gran and I used to watch together in the evenings. And yet there was something very contemporary about Giselle as well, like she bridged two worlds. She invited me in and I thanked her, rolling my trolley in behind me.
"I'm Giselle Black," she said, offering me her hand.
I didn't know what to do. Most guests avoid touching maids, especially our hands. They associate us with other people's grime, never their own. But not Giselle. She was different. She was always different. Perhaps that's why I'm so fond of her. I quickly wiped my hands on a fresh towel from my trolley and then reached out to shake her hand. "I'm pleased to make your acquaintance," I said.
"And your name?" she asked.
Again, I was flummoxed. Guests rarely ask my name. "Molly," I mumbled, then curtsied.
"Molly the maid," she roared. "That's hilarious."
"Indeed, madam," I replied, looking down at my shoes.
"Oh, I'm no madam," she said. "Haven't been for a long time. Call me Giselle. Sorry you have to clean this shithole every day. We're a bit of a mess, me and Charles. But it's nice to open the door and find everything all fresh after you've been here. It's like being reborn every single day."
My work had been noticed, acknowledged, appreciated. For a moment, I wasn't invisible. "I'm at your service, Giselle," I said. She smiled then, a fulsome smile that reached all the way to her feline green eyes. I felt the blood rush to my cheeks. I had no idea what to do next, what to say. It's not every day that I engage in a real conversation with a guest of such stature. It's also not every day that a guest acknowledges my existence. I picked up my feather duster and was about to begin my work, but Giselle kept the conversation going.
"Tell me, Molly," she said, "what's it like being a maid, cleaning up after people like me every day?"
No guest had ever asked me this. How to respond was not a subject covered in any of Mr. Snow's comprehensive professional development sessions on service decorum. "It's hard work," I said, "but I find it pleasing to leave a room pristine and to slip out and disappear without a trace." Giselle took a seat on the divan. She twirled a lock of her chestnut mane between her fingers.
"That sounds incredible," she said, "to be invisible, to disappear like that. I have no privacy, no life. Everywhere I go, I have cameras in my face. And my husband's a tyrant. I always thought being the wife of a rich husband would solve all of my problems, but that's not how it turned out. That's not how it is at all."
I was speechless. What was the appropriate response? I had no time to figure that out, because Giselle started talking again.
"Basically, Molly, what I'm saying is, my life sucks."
She got up from the divan, went to the minibar, and grabbed a small bottle of Bombay gin, which she poured into a tumbler. She returned to the divan with her drink and plopped back down. "We all have problems," I said.
"Oh, really? What are yours?"
Another question for which I was not prepared. I remembered Grand's advice. Honesty is the best policy. Well, I began, I may not have a husband, but I did have a boyfriend for a while, and because of him, I now have money problems. My beau, he turned out to be, well, a bad egg.
A beau? A bad egg? You talk kind of funny, you know that? She took a big gulp from her glass. Like an old lady, or the queen.
That's because of my gran, I said. She raised me. She wasn't very educated in the official sense. She never went beyond high school, and she cleaned houses all of her life, until she got sick. But she schooled herself. She was clever. She believed in the three E's, etiquette, elocution, and erudition. She taught me a lot. Everything, in fact.
Huh, said Giselle.
She believed in politeness and treating people with respect. It's not your station in life that matters. It's how you conduct yourself that counts.
Yeah, I get that. I think I would have liked your gran. And she taught you to talk like that? Like Eliza from My Fair Lady?
I suppose she did, yes. She got up from the divan and stood right in front of me, her chin held high, taking me in.
You have incredible skin. It's like porcelain.
I like you, Molly the maid. You're a bit weird, but I like you.
She then skipped off to the bedroom and returned with a brown men's wallet in her hand. She rummaged through it and pulled out a new $100 bill. She put it in my hand.
Here, for you, she said.
No, I couldn't possibly.
He won't even notice it's gone. And even if he does, what's he going to do about it? Kill me?
I looked down at the bill in my hand, crisp and feather light. Thank you, I managed, my voice a hoarse whisper. It was the biggest tip I'd ever received.
It's nothing. Don't mention it, she replied.
That's how it started, the friendship between Giselle and me. It continued and grew with each one of her extended stays. Over the course of a year, we became quite close. She would sometimes send me on errands so that she didn't have to face the paparazzi that often waited right outside the hotel's front door.
Molly, I've had quite a day. Charles's daughter called me a gold digger, and his ex-wife told me I have terrible taste in men. Will you slip out and buy me barbecue chips and a Coke? Charles hates it when I eat junk, but he's out this afternoon, here.
She'd pass me a $50 bill, and when I'd return with her treats, she'd always say the same thing.
You're the best, Molly. Keep the change.
She seemed to understand that I don't always know the right way to behave or what to say. Once I came at my usual time to clean the room, and Mr. Black was seated at the bureau by the door, perusing paperwork and smoking a filthy cigar.
Sir, is now a good time for me to return your suite to a state of perfection? I inquired.
Mr. Black peered at me over his glasses.
What do you think? He asked.
Then, like a dragon, exhaled smoke right in my face. I think it's a good time, I replied, and turned on my vacuum. Giselle rushed out of the bedroom. She put her arm around me and gestured for me to turn the machine off.
Molly, she said, he's trying to tell you it's a really bad time. He's trying to tell you to basically fuck off.
I felt horrible, like a complete fool. My apologies, I said. She grabbed my hand.
It's okay, she said quietly so Mr. Black wouldn't hear. You didn't mean anything by it.
She saw me to the door and mouthed, I'm sorry, before holding it open so I could push my trolley and myself out of the suite. Giselle is good like that. Instead of making me feel stupid, she helps me understand things.
Molly, you stand too close to people, you know that? You have to back off a bit, not get right in people's faces when you talk to them. Imagine your trolley is between you and the other person, even if it's not really there.
Like this? I asked, standing at what I thought was the correct distance.
Yes, that's perfect, she said, and she grabbed both of my arms and squeezed. Always stand that far away, unless it's like me or another close friend.
Another close friend. Little did she know, she was my one and only. Some days while I was cleaning the suite, I got the sense that despite being married to Mr. Black, she felt lonely and craved my company as much as I craved hers.
Molly, she yelled one day, greeting me at the door in silk pajamas, even though it was close to noon. I'm so glad you're here. Clean the rooms fast, and then we're doing a makeover.
She clapped her hands with joy.
Excuse me? I said. I'm going to teach you how to apply makeup. You're really pretty, Molly, you know that? You have perfect skin, but your dark hair makes you look pale. And the problem is you don't try very hard. You have to enhance what nature gave you. I cleaned the suite quickly, which is hard to do without cutting corners, but I managed. It was lunchtime, so I figured it was acceptable to take a break. Giselle seated me at the vanity in the hallway outside of the bathroom. She brought out her makeup case. I knew it well, since I reorganized each of her cosmetics every day, putting the caps back on things she'd left open and placing each tube or container back in its proper slot. She rolled up her pajama sleeves, put her warm hands on my shoulders, and looked at me in the mirror. It was a lovely feeling, her hands resting on my shoulders. It reminded me of Gran. She picked up her hairbrush and started brushing my hair. "Your hair, it's like silk," she said. "Do you straighten it?" "No," I said, "but I wash it, regularly and thoroughly. It's quite clean." She giggled. "Of course it is," she said. "Are you laughing with me or at me?" I asked. "There's a big difference, you know." "Oh, I know," she said. "I'm the butt of many a joke." "I'm laughing with you, Molly," she said. "I'd never laugh at you." "Thank you," I said. "I appreciate that." The receptionists downstairs were laughing at me today. Something about the new nickname they gave me. To be honest, I don't fully understand it.
"What did they call you?"
"Roomba," I said. "Gran and I used to watch Dancing with the Stars, and the Roomba is a very lively partner dance." Giselle winced.
"I don't think they meant the dance, Molly. I think they meant Roomba, as in the robotic vacuum cleaner."
Finally, I understood. I looked down at my hands in my lap so Giselle wouldn't notice the tears springing to my eyes, but it didn't work. She stopped brushing my hair and put her hands back on my shoulders.
"Molly, don't listen to them. They're idiots."
"Thank you," I said. I sat stiffly in the chair, staring at myself and Giselle in the mirror as she worked on my face. I was concerned that anyone could come in and find me sitting down with Giselle Black, having my makeup done. How to handle guests placing you in this exact situation had never been covered in Mr. Snow's professional development seminars. "Close your eyes," Giselle said. She wiped them, then dabbed cool foundation all over my face with a fresh makeup sponge.
"Tell me something, Molly," she said. "You live alone, right? You're all by yourself?"
"I am now," I said. "My gran died a few months ago. Before that, it was just the two of us." She took a powder container and brush and was about to use it on my face, but I stopped her. "Is it clean?" I asked. "The brush?" Giselle sighed.
"Yes, Molly, it's clean. You're not the only person in the world who sanitizes things, you know."
This pleased me immensely because it confirmed what I knew in my heart. Giselle and I are so different, and yet, fundamentally, we are very much alike. She began using the brush on my face. It felt like my feather duster, but in miniature, like a little sparrow was dusting my cheeks.
"Is it hard living alone like that? God, I'd never last. I don't know how to make it on my own."
It had been very hard. I still greeted Gran every time I came home, even though I knew she wasn't there. I heard her voice in my head, heard her traipsing about the apartment every day. Most of the time, I wondered if that was normal, or if I was going a bit soft in the head.
"It's hard, but you adapt," I said.
Giselle stopped working and met my eyes in the mirror.
"I envy you," she said, "to be able to move on like that, to have the guts to be fully independent and not care what anyone thinks, and to be able to just walk down a street without being accosted." She had no idea how I struggled, not the slightest clue.
"It's not all a bed of roses," I said.
"Maybe not, but at least you don't depend on anyone. Charles and I, it looks so glamorous from the outside, but sometimes it's not. And his kids hate me. They're close to my age, which I admit is kind of weird. His ex-wife, she's weirdly nice to me, which is worse than anything. She was here the other day. Do you know what she said to me the second Charles was out of earshot? She said, 'Leave him while you still can. The worst part is I know she's right.' Sometimes I wonder if I made the right choice, you know."
"As a matter of fact, I do,"
I said. I'd made my own wrong choice. Wilbur. Something I still regretted every single day. Giselle picked up some eyeshadow. Close your eyes again. I did so. Giselle continued to talk as she worked. A few years ago, I had one goal and one goal only. I wanted to be swept off my feet by a rich man who would take care of me. And I met this girl. Let's call her my mentor. She showed me the ropes. I went to all the right places, bought a couple of the right outfits. Believe and you will receive, she used to say. She'd been married to 3 different men, divorced 3 times, taking each man for half his net worth. Isn't that incredible? She was set. A house in Saint-Tropez and another in Venice Beach. She lived alone, with a maid, a chef, and a driver. No one telling her what to do. No one bossing her around. I'd kill for that life. Who wouldn't? Can I open my eyes now? I asked. Not yet. Almost, though. She switched to a thin brush that felt cool and tender on my eyelids. At least you don't have a man telling you what to do. A man who's a hypocrite. Charles cheats on me, she said. Did you know that? Gets jealous if I so much as glance at another man. But he has at least 2 mistresses in different cities. And those are just the ones I know about. He has one here, too. I wanted to strangle him when I found out. He pays off the paparazzi so they don't leak the truth about him. Meanwhile, I have to give him a full report on where I'm going every time I leave this room. I opened my eyes and sat up straight in my chair. I was most distressed to learn this about Mr. Black. I detest cheaters, I said. I despise them. He shouldn't do that to you. It's not right, Giselle. Her hands were still close to my face. She'd rolled her pajama sleeves up well past her elbows. From that vantage point, I could make out bruises on her arms, and as she leaned forward and her top shifted, I saw a blue and yellow mark on her collarbone, too. How did you get those? I asked. There had to be a perfectly reasonable explanation. She shrugged. Like I said, things aren't always great between Charles and me. I felt a familiar churn in my stomach. Bitterness and anger frothing just below the surface, a volcano that I would not let erupt. Not yet. You deserve better treatment, Giselle, I said. You're a good egg. Meh, she said. I'm not that good. I try, but sometimes it's hard to be good. It's hard to do the right thing. She picked a blood-red shade of lipstick from her kit and began applying it to my lips. You're right about one thing, though. I deserve better. I deserve a Prince Charming. And I'll make that happen, eventually. I'm working on it. Believe and you will receive, right? She put the lipstick down and picked up a large hourglass timer from the vanity. I'd seen it there often enough. I had polished its glass curves with ammonia and the brass with metal cleaner to bring it to a high shine. It was a beautiful object, classic and graceful, a pleasure to touch and to behold. You see this timer, she said, holding it in front of me. The woman I met, my mentor, it was a gift from her. It was empty when she gave it to me, and she told me to fill it with sand from my favorite beach. I said, are you crazy? I've never even seen the ocean. What makes you think I'm going to a beach anytime soon? Turns out she was right. I've seen a lot of beaches these past few years. I was escorted to many of them even before I met Charles. The French Riviera, Polynesia, the Maldives, the Caymans. The Caymans are my favorite. I could live there forever. Charles owns a villa there, and the last time he took me, I filled this timer with sand from the beach. I turn it over sometimes and just watch the sand run through. Time, right? You gotta make things happen. Make what you want out of your life before it's too late. And done, she said, stepping away so I could see my reflection in the mirror. She stood behind me, hands on my shoulders again. See, she said. Just a bit of makeup, and suddenly you're a hottie. I turned my head from side to side. I could barely see my old self anymore. I knew that I somehow looked better, or at least more like everyone else, but there was something very off-putting about the change. Do you like it? It's like duckling to swan, like Cinderella at the ball. I knew the etiquette for this, which was a relief. When someone compliments you, you're supposed to thank them. And when they do something kind for you, even if you didn't want them to, you're supposed to thank them. I appreciate your efforts, I said. You're welcome, she replied. And take this, she said, picking up the beautiful timer. It's a gift. From me to you, Molly. She put the glowing object into my hands. It was the first gift I'd received since Gran died. I couldn't recall the last time I'd been given a gift by someone other than Gran. I love it, I said. I meant it. This was something I valued much more than any makeover. I couldn't believe it was now mine, to cherish and polish from this day forth. It was filled with sand from a far-off exotic place that I would never see, and it was a generous gift from a friend. I will keep it here in my hotel locker in case you ever want it back, I said. The truth is that as much as I loved the timer, I couldn't bring it home. I wanted only Gran's things at home. Really, I love it, Giselle. I will admire it every day.
Who are you kidding? You already do admire it every day.
I smiled. Yes, I suppose you're right, I said. May I make a suggestion? She stood there with a hand on her hip while I tidied her makeup kit and cleaned up the vanity. You might consider leaving Mr. Black. He hurts you. You're better off without him.
If only it were that easy, she said. But time, Miss Molly. Time heals all wounds, as they say.
She was right. As time passes, the wound doesn't hurt as much as it did at first, and that's always a surprise, to feel a little bit better and yet to miss the past. No sooner had that thought crossed my mind than I realized how late it was. I checked my phone. 1:03 p.m. My lunch hour was over minutes ago. I have to go, Giselle. My supervisor, Cheryl, will be very upset with my tardiness.
Oh, her. She was sniffing around here yesterday. She came in asking if we were pleased with the cleaning services. I said, I've got the best maid ever. Why wouldn't I be pleased? And she stood there with that dumb look on her face and said, I'll do a much better job for you than Molly. I'm her supervisor. And I'm like, nope. I pulled out a tenner from my purse and handed it to her. Molly's the only maid I need, thanks, I said. Then she left. She's a real piece of work, that one. Gives new meaning to the term resting bitch face, if you know what I'm saying.
Gran taught me not to use foul language, and I rarely do. But I could not deny Giselle's appropriate use of language in this particular instance. I started to smile despite myself.
Molly? Molly?
It was Detective Stark. I'm sorry, I said. Can you repeat the question?
I asked if you know Giselle Black. Did you ever have any dealings with her, conversations? Did she ever say anything about Mr. Black that struck you as odd? Did she ever mention anything that might help our investigation?
Investigation?
As I mentioned, it's likely that Mr. Black died of natural causes, but it's my job to rule out other possibilities. That's why I'm talking to you today.
The detective wipes a hand across her brow.
So again, I'll ask, did Giselle Black ever talk to you?
Detective, I say, I'm a hotel maid. Who would want to talk to me? She considers this, then nods. She is entirely satisfied with my response.
Thank you, Molly, she says. It's been a tough day for you. I can see that. Let me take you home.
And so, she did. Chapter 5. With a turn of the key, I open the door to my apartment. I walk across the threshold and close the door behind me, sliding the deadbolt across. Home, sweet home. I look down at the pillow on Gran's antique chair by the door. She sewed the serenity prayer on it in needlepoint. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. I take my phone from my pants pocket and place it on the chair. I unlace my shoes and wipe the bottoms with a cloth before putting them away in the closet. Gran, I'm home, I call out. She's been gone for 9 months, but it still feels wrong not to call out to her, especially today. My evening routine is no longer the same without her. When she was alive, we spent all our free time together. In the evening, the first thing we'd do was complete that day's cleaning task. Then we'd make dinner together, spaghetti on Wednesdays, fish every Friday, provided we could find a good deal on fillets at the grocery store. Then we'd eat our meals side by side on the sofa as we watched reruns of Columbo. Gran loved Columbo, and so do I. She often commented on how Peter Falk could use a woman like her to sort him out.
Look at that overcoat. It's in extreme need of a wash and an iron.
She'd shake her head and address him on the screen as if he were real and right there in front of her. I do wish you wouldn't smoke cigars, dear. It's a filthy habit. But despite the bad habit, we both admired the way Columbo could see through the conniving plots of the ne'er-do-wells and make sure they got their just desserts. I don't watch Columbo anymore. Just another thing that doesn't seem right now that Gran is dead. But I do try to keep up with our nightly cleaning routines. Monday, floors and chores. Tuesday, deep cleaning to give meaning. Wednesday, bath and kitchen. Thursday, dust we must. Friday, wash and dry day. Saturday, wild card. Sunday, shop and chop. Gran always drilled into me the importance of a clean and orderly home. A clean home, a clean body, and clean company. Do you know where that leads? I could not have been more than 5 years old when she taught me this. I looked way up at her as she spoke. Where does it lead, Gran? To a clean conscience, to a good, clean life. It would take years for me to truly understand this, but it strikes me now how right she was. I take out the broom and dustpan, the mop and bucket from the cleaning cupboard in the kitchen. I begin with a good sweep, starting at the far corner of my bedroom. There isn't much floor space, since my queen bed takes up most of the room, but dirt has a way of hiding under things, of lodging in the cracks. I lift the bed skirts and do a sweep under the bed, pushing any clinging dust forward and out of the room. Gran's landscape paintings of the English countryside hang on every wall, and every one of them reminds me of her. What a day it has been! What a day indeed! It is one I'd rather forget than remember, and yet it doesn't work that way. We bury the bad memories deep, but they don't go away. They're with us all the time. I carry on sweeping through the hallway. I make my way to the bathroom, with its old, cracked, black-and-white tiles that nevertheless shine brightly when polished, something I do twice weekly. I sweep up a few of my own stray hairs from the floor, then back out of the bathroom. Now I'm right in front of Gran's bedroom door. It's closed. I pause. I won't go in there. I haven't crossed that threshold in months, and it won't be today. I sweep the parquet from the farthest end of the living room, around Gran's curio cabinet, under the sofa, right through the galley kitchen, and back to the front door. I've left minute piles of detritus behind me. One outside my bedroom door, another outside the bathroom, one here by the front entrance, and one in the kitchen. I sweep each pile into the dustpan, and then have a look at the contents. Quite a clean week overall. A few crumpet crumbs, some dust and clothing fibers, some strands of my own dark hair, nothing left of Gran that I can see. Nothing at all. I whisk the dirt into the trash bin in the kitchen, then I fill the bucket with warm water and add some of that nice Mr. Clean, Moonlight Breeze scent, Gran's favorite, into the bucket. I carry the bucket and mop into my bedroom and start at the far corner. I'm careful not to splash any water onto my bed skirts, and definitely not on the Lone Star quilt that Gran made for me years ago, faded now from use and wear, but nonetheless a treasure. I complete my circuit, ending again at the entrance, where I encounter a very stubborn black scuff mark at the door. I must have done that with my black-soled work shoes. I scrub, scrub, scrub. Out, damn spot, I say aloud, and eventually it fades before my eyes, revealing the gleam of parquet beneath. It's funny the way memories bubble up whenever I clean. I do wonder if that's the same for everyone who cleans, that is. And though I've had a rather eventful day, it's not today that I'm thinking about, not Mr. Black and all of that wretched business, but a day long ago when I was about 11 years old. I was asking Gran about my mother, as I did from time to time. What kind of person was she? Where had she gone, and why? I knew she'd run off with my father, a man Gran described as a bad egg and a fly by night. What was he during the day? I asked. She laughed. Are you laughing with me or at me?
With, my dear girl, always with.
She went on to say it was no surprise that my mother got caught up with a fly by night, because Gran had made mistakes too when she was young,
That's how she got my mother in the first place. It was all so confusing at the time. I had no idea what to think about any of it. It makes more sense now. The older I get, the more I understand. And the more I understand, the more questions I have for her. Questions she can no longer answer. Will she ever come back to us, my mother? I asked back then. A long sigh.
It won't be easy. She has to escape him, and she has to want to get away.
She didn't, though. My mother never returned. But that's okay with me. There's no point mourning someone you never knew. It's hard enough mourning someone you did know, someone you'll never see again, someone you miss dreadfully. My gran worked hard and cared for me well. She taught me things. She hugged me and fussed over me and made life worth living. My gran was also a maid, but a domestic one. She worked for a well-to-do family, the Caldwells. She could walk to their mansion from our apartment in half an hour. They complimented her work, but whatever she did for them, it was never enough. Can you clean up after our soiree on Saturday night? Can you get this stain out of our carpet? Do you garden as well? Gran, ever willing and good-natured, said yes to every request, no matter what toll it took on her. In so doing, she saved up a very nice nest egg over the years. She called it the Fabergé.
Dear girl, would you pop down to the bank and deposit this in the Fabergé?
Sure, Gran, I'd say, grabbing her bank card and walking down 5 flights of stairs, out of the building and down 2 blocks to the ATM. As I got older, there were times I worried for Gran, worried she was working too hard, but she dismissed my concerns.
The devil makes work for idle hands, and besides, one day it will just be you, and the Fabergé will see you through when that day comes.
I didn't want to think about that day. It was hard to imagine life beyond Gran, especially since school was a special form of torture. Both elementary and high school were lonely and trying. I was proud of my good grades, but my peers were never my peers. They never understood me then, and rarely do now. When I was younger, this vexed me more than it does today. No one likes me, I'd tell Gran when I got picked on at school. That's because you're different, she explained. They call me a freak. You're not a freak. You're just an old soul, and that's something to be proud of. When I was nearing the end of high school, Gran and I talked a lot about professions, about what I wanted to do in my adult life. There was only one option of any interest to me. I want to be a maid, I told her.
Dear girl, with the Fabergé, you can aim a little higher than that.
But I persisted, and I think deep down Gran knew better than anyone what I am. She knew my capabilities and my strengths. She was also keenly aware of my weaknesses, though she said I was getting better.
The longer you live, the more you learn.
If being a maid is what you're set on, so be it, Gran said. You'll need some work experience, though, before you enter a community college. Gran asked around, and through an old contact who was a doorman at the Regency Grand, she learned of an opening for a maid at the hotel. I was nervous at my interview, felt sweat pooling indiscreetly at my armpits, as we stood outside the hotel's imposing red-carpeted front steps with the stately black and gold awning looming over it.
I can't go in there, Gran. It's far too posh for me.
Balderdash, you deserve to enter those doors as much as anyone, and you will. Go on, then.
She pushed me forward. I was greeted by Mr. Preston, her doorman friend.
It's a pleasure to meet you, he said, bowing slightly and tipping his hat.
He looked at Gran in a funny way that I couldn't quite comprehend.
It's been a while, Flora, he said. It is good to see you again.
It's good to see you, too, Gran replied.
Better get you inside then, Molly, Mr. Preston said.
He guided me through the shiny revolving doors, and I took in the glorious lobby of the Regency Grand for the very first time. It was so beautiful, so opulent, I almost felt faint at the sight of it. The marble floors and staircases, the gleaming golden railings, the smart, uniformed reception staff, like neat little penguins tending to well-dressed guests who milled about the stately lobby.
I followed breathlessly as Mr. Preston led me through the ornate ground floor corridors, decorated with dark wainscoting, clamshell wall sconces, and the kind of dense carpet that absorbs all sound, leaving radiant silence to delight the ears. We turned right, then left, then right, passing office after office until at last we came to an austere black door with a brass nameplate that read, Mr. Snow, Hotel Manager, the Regency Grand. Mr. Preston knocked twice, then opened the door wide. To my utter astonishment, I found myself in a dark, leathery den with mustard brocade wallpaper and looming bookshelves, an office I could easily have believed was 221B Baker Street and belonged to none other than Sherlock Holmes himself. Behind a giant mahogany desk sat the diminutive Mr. Snow. He stood to greet me the moment we walked in. When Mr. Preston discreetly padded out of the room, leaving us to our interview, I can readily admit that while my palms were sweating and my heart palpitated wildly, so enamored was I with the Regency Grand that I was bound and determined to land myself the coveted position of maid. Truth be told, I don't remember much about our interview itself, except that Mr. Snow expounded on comportment and rules, decorum and decency, which was not just music to my ears, but rather a heavenly and sacred hymn. After our chat, he led me through the hallowed corridors, left, right, left, until we were back in the lobby, clipping down a steep flight of marble stairs to the hotel basement, which, he informed me, housed the housekeeping and laundry quarters alongside the hotel kitchen. In a cramped, airless, closet-come-office that smelled of algae, must, and starch, I was introduced to the head maid, Miss Cheryl Green. She looked me up and down, then said, "She'll have to do." I began my training the very next day and was soon working full-time. Working was so much better than going to school. At work, if I was teased, it was at least subtle enough to ignore. Wipe, wipe, and the slight was gone. It was also terrifically exciting to receive a paycheck. "Gran," I'd say as I returned home after making my very own deposit to the Fabergé. I'd pass her the deposit receipt, and she'd smile ear to ear. "I never thought I'd see the day. You're such a blessing to me. Do you know that?" Gran brought me close and hugged me tight. There's nothing in the world quite like a Gran hug. It may be the thing I miss most about her. That, and her voice. "Do you have something in your eyes, Gran?" I asked when she pulled away. "No, no, I'm quite fine." The more I worked at the Regency Grand, the more I put into the Fabergé. Gran and I began talking about post-secondary options for education. I attended an information session about the hotel management and hospitality program at a nearby community college. It was tremendously exciting. Gran encouraged me to apply, and to my surprise, I was accepted. At college, I'd learned not only how to clean and maintain an entire hotel, but also how to manage employees, just like Mr. Snow did. However, just before classes were about to begin, I attended an orientation session, and that's where I met Wilbur Brown. He was standing in front of one of the display tables, reading the literature. There were pads and pens being offered for free. He grabbed several and shoved them into his backpack. He wouldn't move out of the way, and I very much wanted to browse the brochures. "Excuse me," I said, "might I access the table?" He turned to me. He was stocky, wore very thick glasses, and had coarse black hair.
"Sorry," he said, "I didn't realize I was in your way."
He looked at me, unblinking.
"I'm Wilbur Brown. I'm going into accounting in the fall. Are you going into accounting in the fall?"
He offered me his hand. He shook it and shook it until I had to yank my arm away to make the shaking stop. "I'm going into hotel management," I said.
"I like girls who are smart. What kind of guys do you like? Math guys?"
I'd never considered what kind of guys I liked. I knew I liked Rodney at work. He had a quality I'd heard referred to on television as swagger, like Mick Jagger. Wilbur did not have swagger, and yet he had something else. He was approachable, direct, familiar. I wasn't afraid of him, the way I was of most other boys and men. I probably should have been.
Wilbur and I began dating, much to Gran's delight.
"I'm so happy you found someone. It's simply delightful," she said.
I'd come home and tell her all about him, how we went grocery shopping together and used coupons, or how we walked in a park and counted out 1,203 steps from the statue to the fountain. Gran never inquired about the more personal aspects of our romance, for which I'm grateful, because I'm not sure I would have known how to explain how I felt about the physical parts, except that while it was all new and different, it was also quite pleasant. One day, Gran asked me to invite Wilbur round to the apartment, and so I did. If Gran was disappointed by him, she certainly hid it well.
"He's welcome round here any time, your beau is," she said.
Wilbur started visiting regularly, eating with us and staying after dinner to watch Columbo. Neither Gran nor I enjoyed his incessant TV commentary and questions, but we bore it stoically.
"What kind of mystery reveals the killer from the beginning?" he'd ask. Or, "Can't you see the butler did it?"
He'd ruin an episode by talking through it, often pointing out the wrong culprit, though, to be fair, Gran and I had seen every episode several times, so it didn't really matter. One day, Wilbur and I went to an office supply store together so he could buy a new calculator. He seemed very off that day, but I didn't question it, even when he told me to hurry up already, as I tried to keep up with his compulsive stride. Once inside the shop, he picked up various calculators and tried them out, explaining the function of each button to me. Then, once he had chosen the calculator he liked best, he slipped it into his backpack.
"What are you doing?" I asked. "Will you shut your damn mouth?" he replied.
I don't know what shocked me more, his language or the fact that he walked out of the store without paying for the calculator. He'd stolen it, just like that. And that's not all. One day, I came back home from work with my paycheck. He visited that evening. Gran wasn't doing so well by this point. She'd been losing weight and was much more quiet than normal. "Gran, I'm going to pop down and deposit this in the Fabergé."
"I'll go with you," Wilbur offered.
"What a gentleman you have there, Molly," Gran replied. "Off you two go, then."
At the ATM, Wilbur began asking me all kinds of questions about the hotel and what it was like to clean a room. I was more than happy to explain the peculiar joy of making hospital corners with freshly pressed sheets and how a polished brass doorknob in the sunshine turns the whole world to gold. I was so engrossed in sharing that I didn't notice him watching me type in Gran's PIN. That night, he left abruptly, right before Columbo. For days, I texted him, but he didn't reply. I'd call and leave him messages, but he wouldn't answer. It's funny, but it never occurred to me that I didn't know where he lived, had never been to his home, didn't even know his address. He always made excuses for why it was best to go to my place, including that it was always nice to see Gran. About a week later, I went to take out the rent money. I couldn't find my bank card, which was odd, so I asked Gran for hers. I went to the ATM, and that's when I discovered that our Fabergé was empty, completely drained. And it was then I knew that Wilbur was not just a thief, but a cheat as well. He was the very definition of a bad egg, which is the worst kind of man. I was ashamed that I'd been duped, that I'd fallen for a liar. I was ashamed to my core. I considered calling the police and seeing if they could track him down. But in the end, I knew that would mean telling Gran what he'd done, and I just couldn't do it. I couldn't break her heart like that. One broken heart was plenty, thank you very much.
"Where has he been, your beau?" Gran asked after a few days of not seeing him.
"Well, Gran," I said, "it seems he's decided to go his own way." I do not like to lie outright, and this was not an outright lie, but rather a truth that remains the truth, provided no further details are requested. And Gran didn't inquire further.
"That's a shame," she said. "But not to worry, dear. There are plenty of fish in the sea."
"It's better this way," I said, and I think she was surprised that I wasn't more upset. But the truth is, I was upset. I was furious, but I was learning how to hide my feelings. I was able to keep my rage under the surface where Gran couldn't see it. She had enough to contend with, and I wanted her to concentrate all of her energy on getting well.
secretly, I imagined tracking Wilbur down myself. I had vivid fantasies about running into him at the college campus and garroting him with the straps of his backpack. I imagined pouring bleach into his mouth to make him confess what he'd done, to Gran, to me. The day after Wilbur robbed us, Gran had a doctor's appointment. She'd been to several in the weeks prior, but every time she came home, the news was the same. "Any results, Gran? Do they know why you're unwell?" "Not yet. Maybe it's all in your old Gran's head." I was pleased to hear this, because a fake illness is far less frightening than a real one. But still, part of me had misgivings. Her skin was like crepe paper, and she barely had an appetite anymore. "Molly, I know it's Tuesday, deep cleaning, but do you think we could tackle that task another day, perhaps?" It was the first time ever that she asked for a reprieve from our cleaning routine. "Not to worry, Gran. You rest. I'll do our evening chore." "Dear girl, what would I do without you?" I didn't say it out loud, but I was starting to wonder what I myself would do if ever I were without Gran. A few days later, Gran had another appointment. When she came home, something was different. I could see it in her face. She looked puffy and strained. "It seems I am a little bit sick after all," she said. "What kind of sickness?" I asked. "Pancreatic," she said quietly, her eyes never straying from mine. "Did they give you medicine?" "Yes," she said. "They did. It's a sickness that unfortunately causes pain, so they are treating that." She hadn't mentioned pain before that, but I suppose I knew. I could see it in the way she walked, how she struggled to sit down on the sofa each night, how she winced when she got up. "But what is the illness exactly?" I asked. She never answered me. Instead, she said, "I need a lie down, if that's all right. It's been a long day." "I'll make you a tea, Gran," I said. "Lovely, thank you." Weeks went by, and Gran was quieter than normal. When she made breakfast, she didn't hum. She came home from work early. She was losing weight rapidly and taking more and more medication each day. I didn't understand. If she was taking medicine, why wasn't she getting better? I launched an investigation. "Gran," I said, "what illness do you have? You never told me." We were in the kitchen at the time, cleaning up after dinner. "My dear girl," she said, "let's have a seat." We took our spots at our country-style dining set for two, which we'd salvaged years earlier from a bin outside of our building. I waited for her to speak. "I've been giving you time." "Time to get used to the idea," she eventually said. "Used to what idea?" I asked. "Molly, dear, I have a serious illness."
"You do?"
"Yes. I have pancreatic cancer." And just like that, the pieces clicked. The full picture emerged from the murky shadows. This explained the loss of weight and the lack of energy. Gran was only half herself, which is why she needed full and proper medical care so she could make a complete recovery. "When will the medicine take effect?" I asked. "Maybe you need to see a different doctor." But as she doled out the details, the truth began to sink in. Palliative. Such an operatic word, so lovely to say, and so hard to contemplate. "It can't be, Gran," I insisted. "You will get better. We simply have to clean up this mess."
"Oh, Molly, some messes can't be cleaned. I've had such a good life, I really have. I have no complaints, except that I won't have more time with you."